So good evening, everybody. Let's generate our motivation. And again, really treasure this precious human life where we have all the conditions to be able to practice our chosen spiritual path. We have the possibility to develop all the excellent qualities that the Buddha taught how to develop them. In other words, the Buddha gave very clear instructions exactly how to develop certain qualities, and we've received those instructions. We have the good conditions to do the meditation and develop them. And so we're very fortunate. But it's not sufficient just to think of our own happiness, to think of me, I, my, mine, to get stuck in I want what I want when I want it. But to look beyond these temporary desires and attachments to something that is of greater benefit to other living beings, long-term benefit to self and others, and also that brings a higher type of happiness and meaning to our lives. And so thus we focus our intentions on progressing along the path to Buddhahood for the benefit of each and every living being. So let's think of that as our long-term, most noble intention for sharing in the Buddha's teachings this evening. So again, with this intention, the real thing that we have to do to cultivate this intention is to look beyond the happiness of this life and the appearances of this life, you know. And that's hard to do because the appearance of this life is so strong. It's what we live in, and everything appears truly existent, and we think it is that way, and this is all our senses tell us and all we know, and it's immediate, so we get very stuck in, you know, my happiness at this very moment. Yeah. But if we look in our experience, we can see where that motivation and that mindset leads us. You know, because my happiness in this very moment excludes other living beings. It excludes our happiness in the future. It excludes our potential to go far beyond what our present capabilities are. Yeah, so it's really a challenge to think beyond the happiness of this life. And that's why the demarcation of what is Dharma and what is not Dharma depends upon if the motivation is looking for the happiness of this life or beyond the happiness of this life. So it's really hard to have a genuine Dharma action when we're completely stuck in the appearances of this life, you know, and where our self-centered thought just comes up at every moment saying, give me this. Yeah, and I don't want that. Yeah, and so our whole life is taken up by, you know, give me this, and doing our best to get what we want, and I don't want that, and pushing that away, you know. And yet all these things we grasp at and all these things we push away are themselves transient. I And we're not going to have them forever, or we're not going to be plagued by them forever either. You know, whether we want to or not, they're going to change, and the situation is going to change. Yeah. I was really touched when I was in Singapore teaching Shantideva. There's this one verse where he is talking about the courage that it takes to practice the Dharma and to really look at our minds and to think about emptiness and dependent arising. Because these things can be quite unnerving because our whole sense of self is dissolving around us, you know. And he was saying that, you know, that's the courage, that's the real battle, is fighting the afflictions. That's what really takes courage. And then he commented that ordinary warriors merely slay corpses. Ordinary warriors merely slay corpses. In other words, when you're fighting in a war as a soldier, if you kill that enemy, it's somebody who's going to die anyway at some time or another. Yeah? So killing external enemies is killing somebody who's going to be a corpse sooner or later anyway. So it's not really worth much. But doing something about the inner enemy of the self-centeredness, the ignorance, anger, and attachment, that's something that is really important and will bring long-term benefit. Okay. So, just thinking, you know, about all these people in the world that think, I'm so strong, you know, I can use this military equipment and kill all these people and impose my will, you know, the dictator imposing their will on the populace. And the whole thing's so completely artificial, isn't it, you know? Because all they're doing is killing corpses, beings that are going to die anyway. Whereas the afflictions are not going to die by themselves. They're going to continue on and continue to afflict us. You know, the only way to get rid of those is to really oppose them and apply the antidotes. And we're fortunate that the Buddha taught us those antidotes, how to think. That, of course, is the opposite way of thinking, that as those afflictions. So when you're in the middle of the affliction, you know, applying the antidote is the last thing you want to do. Because it's the opposite of what your mind is sunk into. Yeah. So this is why we do also try and practice these antidotes when we don't have an active affliction occupying our mind, so that we can get familiar with them and, you know, understand them and be able to apply them in our mind more readily. You know, especially when the affliction comes up and completely wreaks havoc. Okay, so as far as I understand, you completed the quiz. Yes? And I received one email with a couple of questions that was left over from the quiz. So one of the questions was on in the text by Losung Dandrin. There's a quote on page 12 from the Cloud of Jewels Sutra that says, even if a bodhisattva who abides on this ground, the Mahayana path of preparation, is a common being, he or she has thoroughly passed beyond the troubles of children and possesses countless good qualities of meditative stabilization, retention, complete liberation, clairvoyance, and so forth. Okay. And so the question was, what do you mean complete liberation if he's only on the path of preparation? Okay. Well, there's something called the eight complete liberations. Okay. And these are states of meditative absorption that are liberated from the obscurations of absorption. Okay, and so how the Tibetan system defines them as exalted knowers that are not polluted by the afflictions of a complete liberation is an exalted knower, not polluted by the affliction of its own level. So each level, you know, each ground, each path has what it eliminates. And so these complete absorptions are not polluted by certain afflictions. So these, it doesn't mean that it's necessarily eliminated these afflictions from the root, but the manifest form of these afflictions doesn't show, it doesn't come up in these complete liberations. So they're called liberations because they're free from the manifest activity of specific afflictions. Okay? So they're samadhis that free you from attachment to, one school says there are samadhis that free you from attachment to rebirth in the form and formless realms. Okay, so the first three of these absorptions just talk about, you know, how the objects and how you're seeing the objects, and they correspond to the first and second jhanas. Okay, the first three of these three complete liberation, the first three of the eight complete liberations correspond to the first two of the jhanas. The first two correspond to the first two jhanas, and the third one corresponds to the fourth jhana. Somehow the third jhana is left out of it. And then the fourth through seventh complete liberations are the meditative absorptions of the formless realm. You know, infinite space, infinite consciousness, nothingness, and neither discrimination or non-discrimination. Okay, so those are four through seven. The eighth is called cessation of discrimination and feelings. And it's the same thing as what's called the absorption of cessation. So this is the manifest activity of all six consciousnesses. And it's attained by arhats. Okay? So it's the cessation of discrimination and feeling, but actually, that's what the name of it is, but it's actually of the manifest form of the six consciousnesses. So it's a certain kind of meditative state that arhats can go into. So it's said that there's two kinds of absorption and cessation. One is the common one. Okay, so you're just going into that absorption and you're not having any manifest activity of the six consciousnesses, so you're really spaced out, you know, in your thing. But the uncommon absorption on cessation is attained when you first generate the common one, and then within that you meditate on emptiness. So that's got to be an incredible state of mind, because there's no manifest activity of the, you know, of the six consciousnesses, and yet you still can access some subtle consciousness that is meditating on emptiness. Okay, and so in this case, when it's the uncommon meditation, absorption on cessation, cessation means true cessation. Because in that case, it is completely freed of the elaborations of the afflictions and of all dualistic thought, because it's a mind that's completely absorbed in emptiness or suchness. That's the uncommon one. Okay, but here, when it's talking about the bodhisattva on the path of preparation, it's talking about, you know, the first seven plus, you know, maybe the common one. Well, not even the common one, actually, because that's only by arhats. Okay? So that bodhisattva hasn't necessarily attained all of those complete liberations, because they haven't necessarily, you know, attained the four formless absorptions at that level. But many of them have. Okay? So the word liberation can mean different things in different situations. Yeah.
Did you say the elaboration of the affliction?
Yeah, sometimes when it say free from elaboration, it means free from the elaboration of true existence. Yeah, so you have no appearance of true existence. So it's not really of the afflictions, it's of true existence. But that appearance and grasping at true existence gives rise to the afflictions.
And when God was here, he said, when he defined this, I've been thinking about this lately, he said that you see it as a base suitable for like, well...
You see what?
Well, he was defining elaboration.
Uh-huh.
He's an example of someone that maybe we don't like. Mm-hmm. A suitable basis for my anger, a suitable basis, and he kind of gave it that meaning, like, see... I guess we
elaborate on what's there.
And then we are that, so we can then move into the affliction.
Right. But the elaboration means you're putting something on the object that isn't there. Mm-hmm. In this case, true existence. Okay. Mm-hmm. And then the second question was saying, in a passage on the path of preparation in Jeffrey Hopkins' Emptiness Yoga, he says, at the beginning of the path of preparation, yogis can ascertain a subject and object, the wisdom consciousness and its object, emptiness. As they progress along the path of preparation, they can no longer ascertain the sense of an object, even if they were to reflect on it. By the time they have reached the end of the path of preparation, they can no longer ascertain the appearance of the subject either. Okay, so here the question is, what does it mean, ascertain? It means to know that you saw something. Yeah. So at the beginning of path preparation, you're, you know, a new bodhisattva, not somebody who's coming in from the here and solitary real life vehicles, but a new bodhisattva, you know, is still having, they haven't realized emptiness directly, so they're still having the appearance of true existence. So they may realize emptiness, but there's still the appearance of an object, emptiness, and a mind or subject that's realizing that emptiness. So throughout the path of preparation, what you're eliminating is that appearance of there being an object out there and there being a subject here. And first you're eliminating the ascertainment of the object, and then later you eliminate the ascertainment of a subject. And then when you immediately transit into the first moment of the path of seeing, you don't have the appearance of either a subject or an object. Okay.
So I think what I might be struggling with is these words appearance and see. You know, you don't have the appearance of.
Yeah.
And I immediately, my mind goes to the eyes, like the appearance of.
Yeah. No, it means appearance to the mind. So the appearance of true existence.
To the mind.
To the mind. Your eyes have nothing to do with it. Well, that's because you're stuck in your head.
Yeah, I'm stuck on it.
Yeah. Yeah, because when you meditate, you're not meditating with your eye consciousness.
Right, no.
You're meditating with the mental consciousness.
Yeah. I just noticed as you were talking, though, as soon as it's appearance or see, I go very material.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it doesn't mean that.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. Okay. Geshe's Opus says, "Woke." Woke. So now, just to review a little bit, when we were talking about the 10 grounds, you know, that they are all ultimate bodhicitta. In other words, they're all wisdom minds that perceive emptiness directly, and they are differentiated according to 4 factors. Okay, and so the first one is the qualities they have, the numbers of qualities. The second one is the majesty of power, which means what afflictions they're able to eliminate. The third one is the surpassing practice of a particular far-reaching practice. The fourth one is the fruitional rebirth that those bodhisattvas can take in order to benefit sentient beings. So in the last teaching, I went into more depth about the 12 sets of good qualities. Remember, we went through those, the ones that were, you know, I had two different lists, and we talked about those. And so on the first ground, you have 100 of each of those qualities. Yeah. And as you go through the 10 grounds, the number of each of those 12 sets increases as you go through. So on the second ground, you have 1,000 of them. So the first ground sees 100 Buddha, the second ground sees 1,000 Buddhas. Okay, the first ground receives the blessing or inspiration of 100 Buddhas, the second ground of 1,000. Okay, the third ground of 100,000 Buddhas. Okay, so they keep going up in these numbers. Okay, so here now the text is going to start with we went through that regarding the first ground. Now we're moving on to the second quality, which is the majesty of power. And so the mode of achieving the majesty of power on the first ground. Okay, so the degree of power, what this means is each successive ground has greater power to purify the various levels of obscurations and greater power to advance to a higher path. So, for example, the first ground abandons the acquired afflictions. The second through the tenth ground abandons the big through the small middle, rounds of afflictions. The first part of the eighth ground abandons the small, medium, and large of the small afflictions. Yeah. And then the cognitive obscurations are abandoned on the three pure grounds, in other words, bhumis 8, 9, and 10. Okay, so the degree of power means the strength of the meditation on emptiness that makes it capable of eliminating these afflictions. Okay, so to read from the text, it says, a mode of achieving majesty of power exists because the exalted wisdom which realizes emptiness directly, in which one moves from the ground of activities through belief, which ground of activities through belief means path of preparation, path of accumulation and preparation. Okay, through to the first ground. That is to say, you know, what he's talking about here is the exalted wisdom that goes beyond the path of accumulation, path of preparation, and gets you into the path of seeing, okay? That is to say, the 16 moments of knowledge and forbearance, or knowledge and fortitude of the Mahayana path of seeing, okay? Abandons that which is to be abandoned by a path of seeing, the three fetters together with their seeds. Okay, so this is another one of those long sentences. What it means is, you know, that achieving the power of majesty exists because there's an exalted wisdom that can go beyond the path of accumulation, path of preparation, that has the 16 moments of knowledge and fortitude. Remember we talked about that before? So the eight knowledges are uninterrupted paths, and the eight fortitudes are liberated paths. Okay, that this system says they all the knowledges occur in one moment and all the fortitudes occur in another moment, simultaneous, you know, the eight of one simultaneous, the eight of the other simultaneous. Okay, and this happens on the Mahayana path of seeing. Okay, and so this wisdom abandons what is to be abandoned by a path of seeing. And here the text says, the three fetters together with their seeds. Okay, now, the three fetters, Okay, I'll just explain it, and then you'll have some questions. So the three fetters, the first one is the view of the personal, identity, or, you know, what's often called citta, or view of the transitory collection. Okay, so view of a personal identity as a real I and mine. That's the first one. The second one is viewing bad systems of ethics and behavior as superior. You know, like thinking that, drinking will bring you liberation, and jumping on a trident and the center spoke coming out of your crown of your head will bring you liberation, or doing very severe ascetic practices will bring you liberation, or all these kind of wrong ideas about how to free the mind is the second one. And then the third one is afflicted doubt. So the doubt that is inclined towards the wrong conclusion. So these three, okay, view of the personal identity, holding wrong views and mode of conduct as supreme, and afflicted doubt. Okay, these are said to be eliminated on the Mahayana path of seeing. Now, you're going to say, wait a minute. I thought the Mahayana path of seeing eliminated only the acquired afflictions. How come it's saying it eliminated these three? And anyway, something like the view of a personal identity, that one is the root of samsara. That's not eliminated until you get to the eighth ground. So what are they talking about here? So what I think is happening is when you study the Theravada system, you know, that's explained in the Pali Canon, when they're talking about the eight approachers and abiders, in other words, stream enterers, once returners, non-returners, and arhats. In that context, when they're talking about stream enterers, yeah, the approacher to stream entry is eliminating these three, and somebody who is a stream enterer has eliminated these three. So that being a stream enterer is comparable to the path of seeing. Okay? And in that system, it talks about those three being liberated, being completely removed, because in the Pali system, the view of the personal identity is not considered the root of samsara. Only ignorance is. Whereas in the Prasangikas, they say that ignorance is not just a fogginess, an unknowing, an unknowing of the mind, but it's an act of grasping at things existing in the opposite way of how they do exist. So in the case of the person, grasping the person to exist truly, truly existently. So that's how the Prasangikas say. But say that mental factors. But in the Pali system, it's, just a wrong view of the person, but it's not ignorance. And so it can be eliminated before ignorance. Okay? And they say doubt is eliminated because once you realize emptiness, you have no more doubt in the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And once you realize, but see, they don't say emptiness. They say the lack of a substantial existent person. And once you've realized that, then you also have eliminated the view that is attached to wrong modes of conduct, and ethics as the path, because if you hadn't eliminated that, you wouldn't have reached the path of seeing, because you would still have all these wrong views of what the path is. Okay? So I think it mentions those three here as a way of connection with the way it's explained in the Pali system. And it's interesting because Chandrakirti does the same thing when he, explains in the supplement, when he's explaining the first ground. He he does that there too. But in other settings, you know, it's said that the first ground eliminates the acquired afflictions.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, and so these three afflictions, as far as I understand, have both acquired and innate forms, but I'm not totally positive about that. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to get that really clear, because some people say, no, it's just all the acquired afflictions. But then if you think about it, you know, it would seem that some of the afflictions that were more conceptual in nature would have been, you know, some of the speculative afflictions would have been, you know, maybe they could have been fully eliminated here. So I don't know the answer on that question. Mm-hmm. So don't ask that question, because I can't answer it. So I'm telling you beforehand that I don't know. Okay. But that they usually say it's just the acquired afflictions. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then, you know, somehow I still have a little bit of doubt on that. Okay. Because here it says that it's abandoned those three together with their seeds. So if together with their seeds would mean, you know, that they're abandoned completely. Then on the still talking about the first bhumi, then on the occasion of the wisdom subsequent to meditative equipoise, which are induced by that uninterrupted path of a Mahayana path of seeing. Okay, so remember subsequent, you know, the subsequent state, so this is in your break time. Yeah? One accumulates vast collections of merit for the sake of abandoning the great of the great afflictive obscurations of the three realms to be abandoned by the paths of meditation. Okay? So it's saying on the... this is... You can see already there's something contradictory here. You know? Because... or there's some lack of clarity. I can't say it's contradictory, because you can't say great beings contradict themselves. But there's something that I don't understand about this. Okay? Because if you say they have abandoned those three fetters together with their seeds, yeah, then they're completely gotten rid of. But then saying here that on your subsequent attainment time of the path of seeing, you're accumulating great merit that will strengthen your meditation on emptiness to the point where you can actually abandon the great of the great afflictions, or the great of the great afflictive obscurations. And that happens on the path of meditation, because that's when you are uprooting the afflictions completely, not just the acquired afflictions, but really getting rid of the afflictions from the root. Okay, so that accumulation of merit is done to strengthen your wisdom, so that that wisdom can then eliminate the afflictions on the next stage. Okay? Thereby one sees the signs of being able to abandon those. Through setting an equipoise on emptiness, one meditative consciousness becomes an actual antidote to the great of the afflictions, the great of the great afflictions of the three realms to be abandoned by a path of meditation, and simultaneously one is able to pass to the second ground. Okay, so you're on the path of seeing, you know, after your liberated path and your uninterrupted path and liberated path. Then you have the subsequent attainment time. And periodically throughout that, you're also meditating on emptiness. That was the third meditative equipoise on emptiness, that which is neither, you know, an uninterrupted path or a liberated path. And so you're accumulating merit, and you get the sense finally that, you know, you're getting real close to being able to eliminate the great of the great afflictions. And so then when you meditate when you enter into meditation on emptiness, on the path of seeing, again, once more in this third kind, that is neither. Yeah. Then in the same meditation session, your wisdom, the potency, the power of your wisdom gets bumped up, and it becomes the uninterrupted path of the second ground. And then in the same meditation session, the liberated path of the second ground. And there, what in the uninterrupted path, what you're doing is you're freeing the mind from the great of innate afflictions. And in the liberated path, you have freed your mind of the great innate afflictions in such a way that they cannot come back. Okay? So all that happens in one meditation session. Yeah. It doesn't say how long the meditation session is. Because remember, by this time you have samadhi, so, you know, I mean, great samadhi, and you can be in meditation for a really long time. Okay? Okay, so that's what's happening there. Okay? So that's about how to achieve the majesty of power on the first ground. Okay? So that was the second factor, the differentiating grounds. Now the third factor is the mode of surpassing practice of a perfection or of a far-reaching practice on the first ground. Okay? So each of the grounds corresponds to one of the far-reaching practices. And put it this way, on each ground, one of the far-reaching practices, it becomes strong enough so that it's called surpassing. Yeah, so it's a special practice of that, you know. It's surpassing. It's not unsurpassable because the Buddhas clearly, you know, surpass it. But it surpasses the practice of, you know, ordinary beings. When it links each ground to one of these far-reaching practices, it does not mean that that practice is done only on that ground and not on the other grounds. Nor does it mean that no other practice is done on that ground, only that one is done. That's not true. All the practices are done on all the grounds. Okay? So each ground has its own surpassing far-reaching practice in which that bodhisattva's body, speech, and mind are further refined. Okay? So our text says, on this ground, we're on the first ground here, since one has been born into the lineage of the king of doctrine, the Tathagata, one outshines hearers and solitary realizers by way of lineage. Okay? And due to having overcome exhaustively the chance to generate manifest miserliness, whether awake or in dreams, when one gives gifts of one's own body, resources, and root of virtue, one gives them without observing the inherent existence of the three spheres of giving, recipient, and given, like moving something from one's right hand to one's left hand. That was all one sentence. Okay? So what this means is that, you know, there's different levels on the path where bodhisattvas become supreme or superior to the hearers and solitary realizers. So on the path of seeing, they become superior by way of lineage in that they have both the method and the wisdom aspect of the bodhisattva path. Okay? And they have the method. And that method and wisdom, you know, by increasing it, will be able to take them all the way to full awakening. Yeah. Whereas on the here and solitary realizer path, You know, you have also realized emptiness directly, but you don't have that same method because you don't have, you're not creating, you know, huge amounts of merit by having the bodhicitta, because you don't have the bodhicitta on those paths. And having the bodhicitta, because you're working for the benefit of all sentient beings, then every action you do is for the benefit of all sentient beings, so every action becomes very potent. Yeah, meaning it creates a lot of merit. Okay? Okay, so that's one thing that's happened then on the first bhumi. Then the second one is to having overcome exhaustively the chance to generate manifest miserliness, whether awake or in dreams. Okay, so here you no longer have manifest miserliness because you've started eliminating the innate levels of miserliness, but not all of it. But you can't have manifest miserliness, whether awake or in your dreams. Okay? So miserliness, attachment, you know, in your dreams or when you're awake. So then when you give gifts of your body, possessions or resources, and roots of virtue, yeah, so those are the three things, like when we do the Tonglen, what we imagine giving, body, possession, and roots of virtue, those three come up in a lot of contexts. Okay, one gives them without observing the inherent existence of the sphere of three. Okay? So the sphere of three that comes up when we chant the 37 practices of bodhisattvas, so it refers to the actor, the agent, the object, and then the action. But here the action doesn't necessarily always refer to the action. It can be the recipient or the object that's given. In any case, in the context of generosity, because that's your first right, far-reaching practice, that these bodhisattvas are gaining the surpassing level of, then you don't see yourself as the one who's giving, the recipient, the person you're giving to, or the object that you're giving, as inherently existent. Instead, you're seeing that these three depend on each other. Okay? So, in other words, you don't see, you know, okay, there's inherently me, I'm sitting here, one solid object. And there's an inherently existed you, who's another solid object. And there's this package of tissues, which is truly existent. And I'm going to give it to you. Okay? So one doesn't see it like that. It sees that, you know, my being a giver is a totally dependent situation. It's not like I'm a giver independently of the giver, the gift, and the given, and the recipient. But these three all depend on each other. Now we might say, well, that's kind of obvious, sure, you know, like these three got to depend on each other. But as Holiness says, when you really understand mutual relationship, yeah, this one, or mutual dependent, relational dependent arising or mutual dependent arising, that it's not just saying, yeah, you know, you have to have these three and of course they depend on each other, but saying the very identity of that object depends on these other factors. See, in our ordinary way, we would say, well, there's still a truly existent me, and my being a giver depends on, you know, you and the object. But here it's saying that it's not that there's a truly existent me, but that becomes a dependently existent giver. Okay? In our ordinary way, there's a truly existent me, but I become a dependently existent giver, you know, for that time. But rather that our whole, that the way I understand this, which I'm sure is not complete, is that at that moment, we don't really have any other identity aside from being a giver. Mm-hmm. And so that whole identity of I is completely bound up in the whole relationship, mm-hmm. you know, and that you can't differentiate the other person whose whole identity at that moment, you know, is as a recipient or the object, the whole identity of which is a gift, that you can't, you know, these three identities are completely interwoven. Yeah? So, you know, he's talking really about how you can't have one without the other. You know? In the same way, I mean, you can't have long without short. And it's not just, oh yeah, of course you need long and short together. But it's really looking at that thing and, you know, you really can't have long without short. But there's no identity of long without an identity of short. Yeah? And so it is with these three. Okay? So it's quite a surpassing way of giving because you don't have, you know, you really have a very deep understanding of dependent arising at this time. Yeah. And although the things are appearing to you as truly existent, you're certainly not grasping them that way. You're seeing them as like illusions. Okay. And the fourth factor is the mode of taking fruitional rebirth on the first ground. Okay, so the ripening rebirth or fruitional rebirth means the body that a bodhisattva can, you know, be reborn as. Yeah, so it's the ripening rebirth that bodhisattva is able to take. Now, of course, that bodhisattva can also manifest all sorts of, you know, 100 different forms. For the needs of sentient beings. But this is the type of rebirth that they're able to take. And on each successive ground, the bodhisattva is able to take higher rebirths, which gives them more power and ability to be of greater benefit to sentient beings. Because with these different kinds of rebirths, they have contact with greater number of sentient beings, and they have a greater ability to influence those sentient beings. Okay, and so, you know, we're going to have some quotations now, because Nagarjuna talks about each of these, and these quotations will follow. So then our text says, having taken rebirth as a universal monarch, or Chakravartin king, controlling Jambu Vipa, which means our earth, yeah, one furthers the welfare of sentient beings. So the first level bodhisattva is able to take the rebirth of a Chakravartin king that controls just this one earth. Okay? Okay, then, hold on. Okay, so here we have the quotations. We're still reading our text here. So in that way, Nagarjuna's precious garland says, okay, and this is taken from a whole section in Precious Garland where he talks about the 10 bhumis. Yeah, the first of these, first bhumi, is the very joyful. Since the bodhisattva is rejoicing, he or she forsakes the three fetters, we just talked about that, and is born into the lineage of the Tathagatas. We talked about that too. They have the method and wisdom of the Tathagatas. Through the maturation of these qualities, the perfection of giving becomes supreme. The bodhisattva vibrates 100 worlds, okay, and becomes a great lord of the world. Okay, so through the maturation of those qualities, you know, of having eliminated the three fetters and entered into the lineage of the Buddha, then you also have the perfection, which is the third yeah, the third of those, of the four factors. The bodhisattva vibrates 100 worlds. That's referring to the first of those, because that's one of the special qualities. And becomes a great lord of the world. That refers to the fourth one. Okay? So there is a reason for calling this ground the very joyful, because seeing that through the power of amassing the accumulations and subsequent attainment and dependence upon directly realizing emptiness in meditative equipoise, one has a special capacity to further the welfare of sentient beings and to achieve an omniscient consciousness. One attains marvelous mental joy. One of those sentences again. Okay, so the reason for calling this ground very joyful, okay, is because the bodhisattva sees that they have, that through the power of amassing the accumulations and the subsequent attainment time, okay, and that power to amass merit in that time is really enhanced because you've directly realized emptiness and meditative equipoise, so that when you're doing all your practices to accumulate merit, they're all imbued with seeing the interdependence of the three spheres, different ways of translating it. Okay? So that bodhisattva sees that they have a special way of accumulating merit that is now influenced by their wisdom. Okay? And that through that way of accumulating merit that is influenced by wisdom, they now have a special ability to further the welfare of sentient beings. Okay? Because through the realization of emptiness that's given them that special ability to create merit, you know, then they can really work much better for the benefit of sentient beings. So, for example, this bodhisattva, when they're giving something, they're not thinking that they're giving to a truly existent sentient being. So they're not at all attached to, you know, oh, how kind you are that you gave me this, you know, because they're not seeing that person as truly existent. So they're not attached to receiving praise and gratitude and pats on the back and pleasant words that, you know, increase the ego, because, you know, they aren't in that sphere anymore. Okay, and when they're giving something, they're not thinking, oh, this is my inherently possession, you know, this, you know, pack of tissues that I worked so hard, I slaved at my job to get, and with so much hard work, and now I'm really, you know, trying to accumulate merit by giving it to you, you know, and please appreciate it. You know how we give, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, we really have to kind of motivate ourselves to give sometimes, don't we? It's not like giving from one hand to the other hand. It's like, oh, giving and it's no longer mine. I don't have it, you know? Okay. So this bodhisattva doesn't have that problem, because the gift, their possession, even their body, none of these things is seen as a truly existent identity. So they're not clinging to it as something special. Even the merit, I remember I told you the story when I first went to Singapore of the man who, after I led him in a meditation and I said, let's dedicate the merit, he said, oh, but I don't want to. I have so little merit, I don't want to give it away. You know? And I had to... Oh, he was so sincere. He had a real belief in the value of merit. But he didn't understand it properly, that the more you give it, the more you know, the more you have. Whereas we have no problem giving our merit away, basically because we're not so sure merit even exists, you know. So of course, yeah, I can't see it. I'll give it away. I don't feel any loss when I give my merit away. Yeah, because merit is like magic to us, isn't it? You know? So, Anyway, so this bodhisattva doesn't have any grasping around this kind of thing. And so they can really further the welfare of sentient beings because they're not at all attached to anything. So they can give it very freely. So when you can give freely, you can do so much good in the world, can't you? You know, because so often we look around us and there's so many opportunities to give, but we just can't bring our mind to do it. You know, somebody says, can you help me with this? Sorry, I don't have time. Yeah. Or, you know, can you do this for me? Why don't you learn to do it yourself? Or, can you help me with this? I'm not physically strong enough to do it. Ask somebody else. You know, this is how we often are, aren't we? It's like, you need something, don't bother me with it. Figure it out yourself. Yeah? And so, whether giving, you know, we're, of course, you know, with our possessions, it can be hard to give. But especially our time and energy, you know, we really don't want to give. It's like, I want my space. Yeah? And we have such an interesting idea in the West of my space, don't we? We discussed this at the first EML, the idea of my space. I need my space. Well, what in the world is my space? Is it physical space? Is it mental space? Who gives you space? Where does this space come from? And what do we mean when we say, I need my space? Yeah, because we're really attached to it, aren't we? I need my space. Don't bug me. You know, get out of here. Leave me alone. I need my space. Yeah, don't we? I mean, we all have. What in the world does this mean? Yeah, we should have another discussion group about this. Yeah. It was very interesting last time because we use this phrase a lot and we feel it so much. That person's impinging on my space. You know, they're asking, you know, not asking, they're demanding impossible things from me. They aren't respecting me. They're, you know, breathing down my back. You know, they're doing this, they're doing that. They. Because I need my space. But what is this space that we need? Yeah? And where does it come from? Yeah? Because, you know, I need my space. So does that mean I can go in my room and close the door and nobody else comes in? Finally I have my space. Well, if that were the meaning of my space, every inmate in solitary confinement should feel delighted that they have their space. Because they can go in their cell and close the door and nobody bugs them. But we wouldn't want to go in solitary confinement in prison. We wouldn't call that, oh, now I have my space.
It's not mine. That was imposed by someone. In my space, I want to do what I want to do.
So that means my space is I'm the one who imposes the line.
Right.
When other people impose the line, it's their being bossy.
Yes.
When I impose the line, then it's my space.
Exactly.
The result is the same as we're locked in a room by ourselves. The result is exactly the same, isn't it?
Well, no.
But when other people do it, we criticize them. But when we do it to ourselves, we say, finally.
But in one room, you take your bonbons with you.
No, but sometimes when we go in our room, we're so fed up with everybody that we don't care about bonbons. It's leave me alone. Get off my case. I need my space. I don't want to be with anybody. You bug me too much. You know? You want too much from me. Yeah?
But isn't it good on the path when you, okay, we are speaking here about somebody who is on the path of seeing, who don't need this anymore because his mind is already so clear that everything around him is, yeah, too. So, like we need this right now to have a space like the monastery, you know, where you have less distractions. Kind of space for your mind to get into it.
Yeah, we create different environments for different purposes, and definitely we're creating the monastery space for a particular purpose. Okay, here I'm talking not so much about the group space that we're taking at the monastery, but within the monastery, within any group you have.
Yeah, it's the same. I mean,
where we feel, you know, it's like, get out of my way.
Yeah, same, like, equally if you are a group or individually, so when you want to have some space, it means like, for example, when you are living here, you want to get clear with yourself. You express it maybe in the wrong way, you say, this person is the cause for my difficulties. But actually, it's something in yourself, and that's why you express it, I need my space. It's only unconscious. So.
Yeah, because, I mean, you hit it the nail on the head that the difficulty is within ourself. Yeah. So maybe we say, I need my space, meaning I need space to figure it out. But usually when we say, I need my space, we don't mean I need space to figure it out. It's I need space away from you who is causing, who is responsible for my inner disturbance. You know, if we say I need space to figure it out, please give me space. You know, I need a time out. Yeah, I need a time out. I need to go and contemplate it. Everybody understands that. And there's an entirely different energy about saying I need to just go and sit alone and figure this out than saying I need my space. It's an entire different energy, isn't there? Yeah? And when somebody says to you, you know, I need to sit alone and figure this out, you say, please, I respect that. When somebody says, I need my space, but, you know, it's like, boom, this wall has come down. You know, there's now this, you know, wall of concrete between me and the other person that I dare not violate. Yeah, because they have erected that wall of concrete with the intention of pushing me away because in their mind I am the source of their problem. Or in the same way when we say that to other people, you know. It's like, I need my space. Yeah, get out of here. But it's an interesting thing because that mind that says, I need my space, is that a happy mind or an unhappy mind? It's an unhappy mind, isn't it? But we're very attached to our space. But the mind that is goes to the space is not happy. Right, you're in there with that mind, aren't you?
The door, and it's like, uh-oh.
Yeah.
Decorating holes.
Yes, that's when we start decorating our hole, or we start self-medicating, or we do our distraction. You turn on the TV, you turn on the internet, you call your friends, you go, you know.
You put the blanket over your head.
Yeah, you put the blanket over your head and go to sleep. Yeah? Yeah? So it's a, you know, it's a strategy for relieving pain and tension. If we use it in a wise way and say to people, I need some space to figure it out, then we're coming with a sincere intention, aren't we, to work on ourselves. And other people don't feel pressured or pushed away. Yeah? When we say, I need my space. Yeah, then there isn't necessarily within that an intention to work on our own mind. Yeah, there may be, there may not be, but it's more a thing of, you know, erecting the wall against whatever it is that I think is the source of my unhappiness.
I find that I get into that thinking when I'm not taking care of myself. When I'm not keeping the balance, keeping the mind happy and being realistic about what I can do and not do and how my energy is and stuff. I get into, I need my space when I'm not being able to find the wisdom and the self-support within my own mind to take care, so that I impose this by putting this up, saying, well, I'm making it sound like it's everybody out there, but it's almost like talking to myself, because I've gone over the top, past the point of compassion, and now I've got to sort of impose it on myself in this funny sort of way.
Yeah.
As an excuse, almost.
Yeah. So you're saying that needing your space comes from not having taken care of yourself and made sure that you were being balanced, and so you let yourself become unbalanced, and then
because I don't know how to, when I find myself not being able to do that, this is the little system that justifies the needing to go, because I've forgotten what I really need.
Yeah.
By putting it out there, it makes it feel just very strange. But it's,
yeah,
I do it.
Yeah. Yeah, we all do it, I think.
I think it's to me, it's like hearing what people think and not what they're feeling and needing, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes the, when I'm in that mode of hearing only what people think about me,
mm-hmm.
and not hearing for feelings and needs, not listening at a deeper level, that's when space thing comes.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not hearing my own feelings and needs either.
Right.
Which is what you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah, you're not in touch with your own feelings and needs.
And others.
And what you're hearing, whether others are saying it or not, what you're hearing is what they think about you.
Yeah. Or demands or whatever.
Yeah, everything is framed on the outside is impinging on me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, we've gone over. I need my space. We need our space. No, I need my space. You don't need yours. You're supposed to work hard and do everything. I'm the one who needs my space. Because I'm stressed out because of you. Right?
Yeah,
it's all our fault.
Yeah, it's all, everything is, my problems are everybody's fault. Yeah, that's why if I go lock myself in a room all alone, then I'm free from problems. But I have to lock myself in a room alone. If you lock me in a room alone, I battle to get out.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, isn't that? You remember when you were a kid and you had to go to your room? I want to get out of here. I mean, it's so interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I have to have the power to put myself in the room for me to feel good about it. If somebody else puts me in the room, no. Even though the result is the same.
Can I ask a question on a different topic?
Yeah.
We got to answer, but it's the how to think about relational dependence beyond long and short, hot and cold.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can look at those comparisons and that makes more sense to me, but when I actually try to apply it to me,
but
I don't know how to go there.
Okay, well, so relational dependence, everything here, our whole world, everything depends on each other.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can't have any element in this whole system without having the other elements.
Yeah, I hear that. But when I try to like meditate or even reflect, I don't even call it meditation, when I try to really reflect on that, it's hard for me to make the leap from the obviously contrasting things to more...
But no, yeah, but you have to work at it, you know, but you have to make examples in your life that this, you know, that just everything is dependently designated. So what we designate all these things as is depending on what they become and how we see them and what everything else around it becomes.
Uh-huh. So it's not so much looking for the contrast maybe that's where I get hung up, hot, cold.
So no, it's not looking for contrast. Mm-hmm. No, it's not looking for the contrast. It's looking how everything exists as what it is because of the entire situation. Every item in the entire situation being what it is dependent on everything else because everything in it is merely labeled. Okay.
Like you couldn't be a monastic without lay people.
Yeah, but it's not just you can't be a monastic without lay people. I can't be a monastic sitting here in this room without the room and the air and everybody else and without our minds conceiving of what a monastic is and what Vinaya is and the history of Vinaya and what the precepts are and what a monastic mind is and without other people's, and without conventional ideas of what is polite and impolite and what is ethical and unethical, that I couldn't be a monastic. I mean, the whole situation, everything in it is depending upon the existence of everything else. So it's not just two things in binary, relationship with each other, but, it's going beyond that. Okay?
Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah.